right, fans and friends, welcome back to another fantastic episode of Mentioned in Dispatches. We've got another Mentioned in Dispatches podcast rookie tonight. Our buddy Ian is joining us tonight. Ian, how are you tonight?
Hey, I'm excellent. Thank you very much. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for making some time to join us. And then our buddy Cyrano, Jim, is back because he can't help himself. How you doing, Jim?
I'm great, thanks. No, are you kidding? I was hurt. I am drawn to the scent of a podcast.
Yes, yes. So Ian is all over Twitter as it's Rocky Mountain Navy is the Twitter handle, right?
Mountain Navy.
Mountain Navy. Okay.
I go by Rocky Mountain. Mountain Navy is the Twitter handle.
I gotcha. And then you've also got a blog over on the side, right?
I do. I run it's just a little writing project for myself. That's all.
Hey, you know,
some thoughts.
Even those things can be entertaining to read. So, what's the URL on that guy, just so that folks can find you?
Oh, good. I knew you'd ask me that because I blew it away.
Had to Google yourself, huh?
We are. It's Rocky Mountain Navy at WordPress.com. Oh, wow.
All right. There we go.
Forget that.
So if you're looking for Ian, that's where you can find him online, although very active on Twitter, very free with the retweets of some cool new stuff out there. So if you're looking for interesting topics to pay attention to, he's a good guy to follow on Twitter. And then Jim, of course, is the retweet all the Kriegspiels guy, but you've got some newfound popularity going on here, Jim. You seem to have turned into Tabletop Simulator 6 out there, haven't you?
As this, of course, dreadful illness is sweeping the world, a lot of wargamers who weren't giving tabletop... I mean, we've been doing Saturday Night Fights for over a year and a half now. This has been something we've been doing. And all of a sudden, as gamers are starting to have to isolate from each other, they're realizing, holy cow, this is a really neat platform on which to play traditional war games, whether they be Hex and Counter or miniatures or some of the more modern stuff like the coin games and all that. And I, you know, again, it's all proportional. I'm not getting the sort of followers I'd get if we were doing Doom Eternal or anything like that. But we've been adding dozens of people following the YouTube channel. And we've also been getting a whole bunch of people joining in and watching and things like that and talking about it. And also, if you go over to the workshop for Tabletop Simulator, it was overnight that we suddenly got just loads of new content. Usually I jump on pretty much every day just to see what's new in the workshop, and I could scroll through a page of maybe 8-9 things. Now it's dozens of things, and a lot of it is war game related, so people are discovering this is a cool thing, and I think that's awesome. And very glad to have everybody by, because I'm excited to see what people will do.
Make sure you point them to the Armchair Dragoons group on Steam so that they can find us for Saturday Night Fight stuff. Make sure that you point them towards, you know, the organizing threads in our forums so that they can come join us for Saturday Night Fight stuff.
Well, yeah. And it's funny you say that, because I do that because one of the biggest questions people have is, where do I go to play war games? I could see that I can play war games, but where do I go to put a game together? And I often, and my first and typically only answer is, hey, we got a forum. Come on by.
Yeah. We've got like a whole section dedicated to Saturday Night Fights, and we probably need to rename it SNF and Tabletop Simulator, you know, so folks can play on Thursday and like, it's not going to hurt our feelings or any.
Sure.
The other thing is, you know, I'm a pretty frequent follower of several of the Wargamer groups on Facebook, and I can't tell you how many times I've pasted in the link to the podcast that we did last year about the Tabletop Simulator. Like, after you'd had, you know, 8-9 months of this under your belt last year, we did a whole episode just on Tabletop Simulator. Hey, Jim, tell us how this works, you know, and had you walk everybody through front to back, sort of, here's how you set it up. Here's how you find games. Here's how you find content. Here's how you do things, you know. And it was, you gave a great tutorial on sort of Tabletop Simulator 101. And I've linked this thing to a ton of folks. I have no idea how many of them have bothered to listen to it, because most folks are probably not going to bother. They'd just rather ask questions over and over. But look, you and I both know that's true, right?
Yes.
You from your day job and me from having taught college. So we know that's
there
true.
You go.
But yeah, I mean, there's been an incredible amount of interest in it. And it's also cool to see how many of the wargamers out there are streaming what they are playing, even if it's not Tabletop Simulator stuff or when it is. Folks are still streaming all kinds of things, like, you know, Gary and Patrick have been playing Victory Games Civil War on Vassal and streaming that. They were supposed to be live earlier tonight. They had something come up that kept them from doing it. But those guys have been streaming Victory Games Civil War for like the last 2 weeks. Moe's Game Table has their Whiskey Charlie, war game chat going on where he gets, you know, Dan Picaldi and some other dudes jump on there with him and they basically live stream a talk show. So, you know, who knows? Maybe we could live stream one of these podcasts one day, but Ian, Tabletop Simulator, you been on there before?
You know, I'm sort of an older-fashioned grognard. I've tried to play with Vassal. I look a little bit at Tabletop Simulator, but when it comes down to it, I am a good hex and cardboard sort of guy.
Yeah.
The boys, my boys, I got three boys, and they'll play around with some of the digital stuff. But for myself, it's really the games are on the table and sitting around the table. So it's made all this COVID stuff very hard because you can't get to a larger group. You're being really confined, a lot of solo gaming and such. So maybe I should try, reach out, you know, stretch my digital tendrils here and see if I can make something out of it. But this just hasn't been my thing.
I will tell you, there's no point really in even asking Jim at this point because he's going to gush all over how awesome Tabletop Simulator is. I've watched these dudes play a bunch over the last year and change because my second job is I work weekends at a local soccer facility. So, you know, I'm at a gym on Saturday nights. Basically, there's no way that I can play because I'm working and the background noise would be intolerable. Never mind the fact that I'm working and not able to commit to a game. But with everything being shut down right now because of the COVID stuff, I've been able to play at least one of these things. It is not going to replicate the beer and pretzels hanging out with your buddies around the table in that same way. It is as close as you can possibly get without having them a bunch of them in the room with you. Tabletop Simulator is closer to that than Vassal ever will be. You're actually looking at a tabletop. Like, you can pan around and zoom and swoop and whatever else, but especially with everybody in the chat together, like, you can't reach over and smack somebody in the head when they do something stupid, but that's about the only thing you can't do. You know, I mean, everything else kind of works the same. And I was really surprised at how immersive it did feel as a part of all that. So,
well, I am glad that in some ways, you know, what's going on now is forcing folks like myself to try to stretch out and do a bit more. I think the gaming industry was already moving towards a little bit more of a social. I mean, we're seeing where I live, board game cafes showing up,
yeah,
and such. But this is another way of doing it. Maybe, you know, I'm glad to see something beyond Vassal. I don't have nothing against Vassal. I'm not a tech Luddite, but it still is challenging in some ways. And seeing something like Tabletop Simulator out there that's a little bit more intuitive, a little bit more user-friendly, it's okay, guys. I'll give it a shot this next week.
Well, if only you knew when a game was going to happen.
Oh, let's see. Oh, Saturday night.
Jim, what's on the schedule for this week, knowing full well that it will have already happened by the time anybody's listening to this?
This weekend is part two of the Battle of Friedland. We got through our first half of the game on Saturday night last. We actually blazed through it. We are celebrating the release of the attach feature, which for the first time allows us to have massive trays filled with virtual toy soldiers, and four of us shoved, I think I counted, it's about 800 to 1,000 soldiers at each other for the better part of 3.5 hours, and we'll wrap up again on Saturday.
There you go. If only Napoleon could copy and paste the way you do.
Yeah, that. Why did you hurt my feelings by saying such things?
We didn't invite Ian in here just to talk about Tabletop Simulator stuff. We also wanted to cover something that's a little topical based on the news lately, and I doubt it will have died down in the week and a half or so it will take for us to actually release this podcast. For folks that hadn't seen it, there are articles about it in a couple of different places. PAX Sims is one of them. The Tabletop Attorney over on Twitter has a link to a story on his blog about it as well. It originally appeared on some sort of TechCrunch blog, something or other. There's a game out there that, and I'm putting game in air quotes, although you can't see them on a podcast. There is a game out there that was developed by a pair of Army officers studying at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And the Naval Postgrad School, it's not a required school for military career progression the same way the Command and General Staff College is for U.S. Army officers. Ian, I think the Navy's probably got something similar for those mid-career guys.
They have a war college.
Well, there's the war colleges, the senior guys, the 05 promotables and 06s, but down at the 03, 04 level, those senior 03s, junior 04s, the Army's got the Command and General Staff College where you're going from being a company grade officer operating in a specific specialty like an armor guy or an infantry guy or an artillery guy to being more of a generalist to be able to do lots of staff work across multiple, across the multiple specialties in the Army. I've no doubt the Navy's probably got a similar school, again, for those senior 03s, junior 04s, that's that mid-career school, before you get to the War College stuff up at the 06 level, right?
They do. A lot of times, many times, it's something as simple as department head school.
Okay.
But when it comes to, like, the gaming stuff, like what these guys are doing, the Naval War College is really the place where that happens.
Yeah, yeah, and the Army War College does a ton of stuff with different kinds of war gaming. Some years it's a little more organized than others, kind of depending on who happens to be at the faculty, on the faculty at any given point in time. But the Naval Postgrad School isn't a requirement for career progression the way something like Command and General Staff College is or some of the others. So it's one of those things that folks will end up at for a variety of different studies. And one of them is, they do have an unconventional warfare program there. They do have a significant wargaming component. I actually have a friend who was in the National Guard with me out in California who was on the faculty there for a little while as a part of that wargaming team. So there is a component of it out there. And these two guys, as a part of their master's thesis at the Naval Postgraduate School, developed a game that they called Insurgent Uprising. And the big news about all of this was that they had applied for a patent on the game. Now, we'll circle back around as to how smart the idea of a patent was for protecting intellectual property. But the news kind of came out, these guys, there was a Twitter feed for Soft Tech News or something like that. I don't remember the exact name of the feed. I did take a screenshot. I'm going to look. Yes, Soft News at SOF News Update had linked a story from the techlinkcenter.org that was about this insurgent uprising game from a couple of military officers at NPS and the fact that they were patenting this thing because they thought it would be cool to sell to civilians. Except that when you open the patent application, when you look at when you go look at the article about it, when you read any information about it at all, Ian, it's a straight ripoff of what?
Catan.
It was almost a dead ripoff. I mean, the board is the hexagonal tile layout from Catan. You've got the ports around the edges are your resource loading points. You're putting bases and infrastructure at the intersections of the hexagons that allow you to do things with the different hexagons that are adjacent to you. You're building, what was it, like logistics pathways? They didn't call them roads. They called them something else kind of crazy that connected you to, connected your infrastructure locations and your bases and whatever else. It was a dead straight ripoff of Catan and not even a good one from all appearances. So news came out. I guess in the last day or so, if you go look at the patent application, it says that the patent something or other has been mailed. Like, these guys got the patent, which is insane. Just as we're recording this podcast, you'll be able to follow some of the links that we are going to put on here. So, Ian, when you saw this whole thing, what was your first reaction to this whole thing?
Well, I couldn't believe it, for one. Part of my day jobs is I work alongside some of the professional DoD war gamers. And so looking at a game and reskinning it and making it into your story is something that I see a lot of them do. When I first saw this, it was like, okay, well, they had a game, they like it, they saw that here's some ways we can retell the story, so to speak. And they did that. But the part about going and getting a patent for it, that part just really, everybody I talked to was just really scratching their heads about that. But why do you patent it? I mean, what's the difference between a patent and a copyright? Which I don't think we even know the answer to that today. But, so my first reaction was, oh, hey, you know, they took a game, and they, look at this. They reskinned it. That looks great. It's awesome. They took some proven mechanics and put it together so it can tell the story and do some education or some training for some of the soft folks. Awesome. But a patent? That's too far, even for me.
Yeah, so something that sort of popped up in all of this, there's been some discussion that's floated around on Twitter, and I think you jumped into a couple of the conversations here and there. There's a guy out there who's actually based in Monterey, and whose Twitter handle is The Tabletop Attorney. And he pointed out, you know, hey, your original tweets about it were one of the ones that he brought up. And he had posted an article talking about the sort of intellectual property rights and the patent being issued and all of these things. And so he does break down some of the distinctions between trademarks and copyrights and patents that I'm not going to try to fully encapsulate on the podcast. The column is linked to our podcast, so you can go look at it and read it yourself there. So there are trademarks that are sort of your branding, almost is the best way to describe it. Your logo, your, you know, the terms involved with you, so long as they're unique. And the example he uses, the golden arches of the M for McDonald's. The copyright is the one that I'm most familiar with from my background in the media and having, you know, been shoved through multiple courses on media law when I was in grad school. Again, not a copyright lawyer, but I understand that one a little better than most. And that is creative expression tangibly fixed. And in some of the clarification conversations we had with this gentleman on Twitter, you know, he pointed out that a copyright probably isn't the most appropriate because the copyright would apply to things like the artwork in the game. So you couldn't steal the artwork of the game. But the patent, as he says, you know, generally protect, quote, inventions, and would apply to structural, mechanical, and procedural aspects of a game or product. Under the law, a patent can be granted to any process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter of, or any new and useful improvement thereof, granted that it is new and non-obvious. And so, you know, he goes on to explain why it's so rare in the tabletop community. But one of the other things that I thought was interesting that he brought up is that the patent as they've applied for it is very, very narrow. And the example he uses is that they describe the map as being built out of hexagons. So you could build the exact same game, build it out of pentagons or octagons, and they can't file a patent claim against you because you didn't violate what they filed for in their patent. But I think what a lot of us are concerned about, and I know Jim's gears are turning in his head a little bit about this also, is the idea of the precedent that this sets. These guys went and patented a straight ripoff of an existing game and got it through the patent office, because let's face it, the guys at the patent office don't know shit about the tabletop gaming community right now. There's no way in hell any of those guys recognized even one of the best-selling tabletop games of all time. They didn't recognize it. And how many patent trolls are going to run out and go start trying to patent Carcassonne and Seven Wonders and whatever else so that they can turn around and start slapping patent infringement suits on all these popular tabletop publishers. Jim, what's your reaction on all of this, where we are to this point?
We all wondered what was going to happen when they patented some of the mechanics and Bang the Dice game. Because to your point, look, I've got a lot of experience with copyright for a lot of reasons I don't care to go into right now because they involve government, which is everybody's favorite topic all the time. But when you're talking about a patent, you're talking about something very, very specific and very, very procedural. And the one that I know you got into, Brant, the example that I always use, actually, is the fact that the folks that own Magic the Gathering own the word, the mechanic tapping, insofar as you call turning a card 90 degrees to the left or right tapping as you do in Magic. That's patented. If you do that same thing, if you have a card game that turns a card, you can't call it tapping without infringing the patent that is held by the folks that own Magic the Gathering. So it's not the aesthetic, it's not, as you say, the brand, the golden arch. It's this physical piece of the game. And people began to wonder when Bang the Dice Game did this and they did this, well, wait a minute, how much of this can you patent? Because it is what everybody freaked out about was actually the wrong thing. Everybody did the very normal, understandable thing. They looked at the game and they went, that's Catan. Everybody who knows games knew it was Catan. But as all the articles point out, the game itself isn't Catan. It's a whole different game with Catan looking pieces, with pieces stolen from Catan. And yes, it has some resource sharing and things, but it's also got a whole lot of stuff that isn't Catan. And they really can't patent the look of Catan. They have to patent a series of processes, because patents are only tangentially related to the intellectual property world. They're the physical world.
Yeah.
Usually, we leave all that tangential intellectual stuff to the realm of copyright. So this really had to be some, and what the concern is, how far are you going to, because we all know, we all play games. Chit pull. We all know what that is.
Yeah.
Deck building. This bag of dice, or drawing from a dice bag. That sort of a mechanism. How many of these mechanisms are people going to be allowed to patent? And I think that's where the concern came in. And it's a blithe thing to say, as is, and it's true. Look, I happen to be friends with the guy who is the chief intellectual property attorney for Fomation, the guys who do the Cheesehead.
Okay.
So if you ever make a knockoff Cheesehead, you're going to get a C&D from my guy. You'll get it, and boy, oh boy, will they enforce that.
Does it have to be a yellow Swiss cheese head?
It is so, because it's a patent.
So I can do a Brie head. I can do a head of Brie.
If you do a Brie head, they're going to find you. You know, but honestly, he makes a very good living. He's an honest, fine fellow. He's been a friend since high school. He by the way, is also a former captain in the Army Rangers. He's an upright guy and the best guy. He will take you down whatever rabbit hole you want to argue, oh, no, I was making the Mongolian beaver cheese hat. You want that fight with my guy? You'll get it. Because that's their whole business.
Yeah, yeah.
But he will tell you it is actually shockingly easy to get a patent for the exact reason you said, combined with government bureaucracy. When you screw down to this narrow, narrow level of the mechanics of this game, the patent guys at the office read through the brief. Did you check all the boxes? Did you fill out the stuff? Does it seem credible? And because they went so narrow, because it is so narrow, they went, yeah, sure, whatever, because they know it's going to be nearly impossible to enforce this patent.
Yeah. I totally understand the motivation behind this, right? These guys developed something they think was kind of cool while they were in grad school at Naval Postgrad, and they've decided that they wanted, you know, the folks at Naval Postgrad are trying to help. It's the staff judge advocate there who helped them file these things. The guys there, they're trying to help these dudes out and give them some intellectual property protection to go out and try and commercialize something that they developed while they were in grad school. And that's cool. Like, totally admire the motivation behind it all. Like, I don't think any of us would really begrudge those dudes the ability to take this out and try and commercialize it. And quite frankly, some of us might even enjoy trying to play it, particularly because we might be able to get some of our, you know, Catan friends to sit down and play something that's got a little more blood and guts that would appeal to us Wargamer types, right? So,
yes.
So we might not mind from that perspective. However, I get the sense that the guys involved in the initial application here had absolutely no clue how the board game industry works when you start trying to solicit designs to people with the kinds of non-disclosure agreements and intellectual property protections that guys like GMT or Mayfair or Lock and Load or any of these other publishers offer their designers. There aren't a ton of in-house, like Fantasy Flight's got a ton of in-house designers. They got dudes that live there and do work for hire. Got it. Dave doesn't have a ton of dudes living with him in Colorado that are sitting there doing design work. Those guys are spread all over the globe, and a lot of them are selling designs to Dave. That's what our boy Steve Overton did with the new version of Fireteam that they've rebooted, right? Steve had a cool idea for a game. Dave said, yeah, I'll buy that. And they cut a deal, and Dave's going to publish Steve's game for him. Same thing. I mean, those kinds of designs are all over the place. Right? I don't think, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure Volko doesn't work for GMT, right? He works for the CIA still.
Correct.
I could totally understand someone's confusion given how many Volko games have been churned out by GMT, but Volko's got a day job, and he does, you know, he sells games to GMT, and I gotta believe that the dudes at Naval Postgrad just didn't have a clue how the industry is set up, and so they were taking what they thought was the best path forward, where they did a ton of research in the design of the game and absolutely zero research about how to actually sell this thing. And so I don't think anybody's really got an issue with our boys trying to make a buck off of this. I really think everybody's got an issue with the precedents that they're now setting that open the board gaming world up to all sorts of unforeseen consequences down the line. And so, you know, Ian, you were involved in some of these discussions on Twitter that you saw going back and forth. What are your thoughts on sort of where these guys ended up with at this point?
Well, they did a thesis, and the thesis actually was almost 2 years old now.
Yeah.
And I don't think they really had at the time had any intention of going out and they were trying to get an A. They weren't trying to sell a game. But I don't think they thought through all the impacts. And I think one of the biggest ones the night that retweeted, I was reading through Tom Russell from a Hollins,
yeah,
and his reaction. And I think what really is unknown here is what the impact to designers is going to be, because I think we oftentimes hear, oh, you can't copyright the game mechanics. I mean, Star Wars is a game, so you can copyright the IP, but the mechanics underneath it, you can't. You know, there's this myth out there, I guess, that you can't copyright mechanics. But when we started scratching the surface of that, like this is doing, I think we're starting to see that, yeah, you can protect them in some way, be it a patent or maybe not a copyright. And that's got people running scared. And I think folks like Rex, the tabletop attorney out there, Tom, and others are all starting to look at this going like, oh, wait a minute, what is this going to do to the industry? It's already hard to get a game published. You have to be careful with protecting people's intellectual property and such. And now it's going to be like, I can't use a certain word. Like you said, chit pool. Am I going to not be able to describe my game? Or if I do that, I have to pay somebody to be able to do that. I think there's a lot more unknowns out there. And this is probably a good time for this to show up, because it's going to force people to have the conversation. Hopefully people in the industry, I'd like to really hear what folks like Uwe Eichert from Academy Games would say, or even somebody like Steve Bonacore in Stronghold. You know, this is their life. What do they think about this, and are they really worried? I also am interested to see Mayfair and Catan going to weigh in. I saw one tweet that their attorneys were aware of it and they were weighing their options, but options cost money, and I'm sure that's going to go into the equation here. Do they just ignore it?
If anybody out there has the money to challenge it.
But I don't know what Mayfair's suit is.
Yeah, they may not have one.
I don't know what it is, because
if you dug into this, maybe they don't.
You know, nobody disputes. Common sense tells you, yeah, that's the Catan board. But that's not what these guys have gone and patented.
Right, and you make a great point there, because I think a lot of folks, I mean, myself too, I was guilty of it. I looked and I said, oh my God, they've copied, patented Catan. Well, the material and components they use certainly come from Catan, but you're right. When you dig down into it, the game itself is not necessarily, I have my own some ways of interpretation, but it's not, they've defined it narrowly. And maybe the tabletop attorney out there is right. They've done it so narrowly that it's not Catan. They've patented their own thing and they just happen to be looking like Catan. If they change that, then everything's fine, I guess.
Well, and to be clear, there are other views out there that are expressing not panic, but concern.
Yes.
Because, first of all, I'm going to agree with you, Brant, that I think a lot of the people, including certainly the tabletop attorney, are saying, these guys don't read like guys who knew exactly what they were doing.
No.
Because even their patent is wrong in the judgment of the attorneys I've read, that it's too narrow. I know this to be true. With a patent, you start broad and you go to narrow because you want it to be broad so you can enforce it.
Yep, yep.
You know, if you got to get down in the weeds on these tiny, tiny little mechanics, you're going to lose, because somebody's going to be able to say, oh, no, I didn't say that it was a plus one that resulted in victory, but a plus two. Aha! You know, you can raise those sorts of objections because you have to make an argument for uniqueness. But the other side is, and it goes to that phrase that you used early on, Brent, and that is the patent trolls.
Yep.
I get, I'll say a dozen, round numbers, copyright trolls that come for me in my line of work every year, whether it be about books we use in our library, whether it be music we use at the various facilities I'm responsible for, whether it be any of these things. They say, you know, ASCAP is famous for this.
Yeah.
You know, we think you're probably using our music, and we think we should probably sit down with you and negotiate a fair licensing arrangement. And when I send them the stock letter from our attorneys that say, we checked, we got nothing of yours, and we make sure to never touch your stuff because we don't want to deal with it, they get very prickly. Oh, are you sure? Yes, I'm sure, because this is what they do. They don't do anything. They don't create anything. They just go out and make sure that you're They want to sow the doubt that you're doing something that's in violation of a copyright they hold. And the fear here is, as, and by the way, the reason we're here, the only reason we're here, is because now the hobby game market is so bloody big.
Yeah.
You know, we're gone are the days that it's Monopoly, Sorry, King Oil, two, three other games, and that's it. No, no, no. There are million-dollar games out there. And the concern is that suddenly a few of these guys are going to show up and start going, hey, I hear you got a game where you take cards and turn them to the right. You know, that's something we patented, and you really ought to pay us if you got a game like that. So maybe you need to give us a cut of your Kickstarter gross.
Yeah.
That's the real fear here.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a not illegitimate fear.
Right. I don't think we're in a realm of panic, but I think it definitely bears watching.
There's another side of this also, and that's the professional wargaming side of it. So going back with 2015, then Undersecretary Work pushing for wargaming across the DoD,
yeah.
Part of that response has been the growth of the coming forward of a lot of wargaming departments. And even this thesis probably was in some ways an outgrowth of that push for, hey, let's get more wargaming into the industry or into the department. And something like this now where they've gone off and patented it could actually have a negative impact on the department, because the easy way, sometimes the best way, a good way of doing it is to take something that exists out there, reskin it, modify it, you know, throw in your classified data or whatever, and you make a war game out of it. But these guys may be actually putting a damper on that, because now, oh, wait a minute, we can't even do it for professional reasons because we got a patent attorney over there that's going to tell us we can't. So, I mean, there's a whole other side of this that I think in the circles that I read and run around, they're worried about it too, because these guys may have, you know, spoiled a good thing that was going on for the department.
Yeah, you bring up the professional side of things, and so there's definitely a point in there that I wanted to get to at some point in this discussion, and that is we're certainly a little wrapped around the axle at the moment about the idea of this being, patent or not as a good idea or not. Let's face it, this thing really looks an awful lot like Catan, and anybody sitting down to look at it's going, oh my God, they just made an insurgent version of Catan. And Jim, our good buddy Doug has mocked it endlessly on Twitter and other places. And it, at first glance, he's not wrong, but I'm real curious I've downloaded the thesis. I've not found the time to read it yet, just with other things that I've got going on with my regular job. I'm real curious to see how the training value is expected to be extracted from this particular game. What are the lessons they're trying to impart on the players, and in what fashion do they expect those lessons to be absorbed based on the way this is supposed to be getting played? And I'm coming at this with a little, look, I don't have a great position of strength. I'm not Mike Markowitz or Peter Perla that's been doing this for a living for 30 years or anything. But I've at least got a couple of professional designs under my belt, including one specifically for strategic level counterinsurgency ops. Right, longtime listeners of the podcast have heard me talk about the Gemstone game a whole bunch. The Gemstone game was built for the National Defense University as a training tool for the International Counterterrorism Fellows. I'm not giving away any state secrets here. Michael Peck wrote a cover story about this and a couple of other games for Training and Simulation Journal about 8 years ago. So there's nothing that I'm talking about that's supposed to be underlocking. This game was designed for the International Counterterrorism Fellows Program at the National Defense University to help with a variety of things at the start of the course, helping the faculty assess the knowledge of the incoming students, helping the students get to know each other, helping the students sort of establish a baseline experience that the faculty could use as a common point of reference for everything else they were about to teach over the next year. The students participating in this game were senior level officials, mostly from foreign countries. Out of 80 students, you'd have maybe a dozen Americans in there. And the dozen Americans, you're looking at senior colonels. You're looking at SES level guys, for folks that aren't familiar with how the government structure works. SES is senior executive service. They're essentially the generals of the civilian service in the government service. So guys from like Department of Energy would be involved. But then you've got some you know, Ukrainian one-star general wandering around. You've got some Nigerian deputy under foreign secretary, somebody or other, literally from all over the world. The Aussies were always kind of fun because you think you've heard Australian accents on TV, but until you've tried to actually understand an Australian accent speaking technical details, God help you. But we built the company I was working for at the time worked with the National Defense University. They had come up with an underlying model that they wanted designed into the game, and we figured out a way to make this game for them to actually play over the course of a week. And I can go through very specifically with that model with folks and explain, here are the things we cared about in the model, and this is why we cared about them for the way the curriculum was set up, the things the faculty wanted us to teach, the things we wanted to make sure were in there that conformed with particular facets of U.S. policy and U.S. doctrine. I can give you a reason why everything is in that model and what the students were expected to learn out of it. And we built the game around the model that we wanted the students to be able to learn how to operate. I'm real curious to see what the underlying model, the underlying lessons were that they're expecting folks to get out of Catan with insurgent bases and, you know, offboard resupply. I'm just, you know, it's one thing to just gain a general sense of awareness of the kinds of conditions that affect counterinsurgencies. It's another thing to highlight the outsized influence of political capital of just making sure that the people responsible for decision making are present and are a part of the process and are seen as engaged with the population and not just some elites locked away in an ivory tower somewhere. Don't bother us, poor masses. Just take our edicts and live with them. Those are the kinds of things that we put into our model because they were important for the lessons they wanted us to execute. And so I'm very curious, and I don't know how well this is addressed in the thesis, because again, I haven't read it yet, but I want to see how they're expecting those lessons to be learned. Ian, you mentioned you've got some familiarity with the professional wargaming world. What is your sense of how those lessons might be imparted or might be expected to be learned from what's floating around in this game?
I think, let's be clear first off. This was a master's thesis, and not to say that master's is nothing, but you know, this is not a PhD piece of work. I think they were looking for a way, what I recall when I read through it, they were looking for a way that is to impart some of the basic lessons of just working in a counterinsurgency environment. They used the having to get your resources, move your resources around, and being able to work against a populace maybe that is sometimes with you and sometimes against you. I didn't see anything that was really super in-depth, insightful. I sort of gathered it was more, hey, here's an interesting way to try to communicate these lessons that's more, goes beyond just reading a book or reading a text or reading a PowerPoint. Let's sit them down and have them push around some stuff and experience it more, which is a lot what DoD gaming tries to do. Give them some experience, try to get the policy folks to start thinking about it more than just a PowerPoint deep. So it's there, but I don't think when we dig into it, you're going to see that it's super, super insightful. It's a nice way of trying.
Jim, you're chuckling.
I was just in the dictionary looking up the phrase "damning with faint praise," and I think I saw that description right there.
I try my best.
I think you just found it there.
No, It is one of the constant challenges, and Dr. Sterrett talks about it all the time, of imparting complex, building complex situations into comprehensible, digestible mechanics. So, yeah, I think that's certainly a likely product of that.
And I think one of the better comments that I saw was if they were going to rip off a game to try to teach counterinsurgency, they would have done a lot better doing Root than doing Catan.
Well, don't see, you get me started on that, and then I get into the whole argument that I got into with a very famous coin designer, not the coin designer, but a coin designer, that Root is a coin.
And what kills me about all this is,
but I'm serious, one of the coin designers and I stopped talking to each other briefly.
What kills me about all this is I get that these dudes, like you said, Ian, they're building a master's thesis, and so they're concerned with how do I graduate, right? I get all that. But if you're trying to put a board game out there for guys to learn principles of counterinsurgency, I can think of 15 others off the top of my head that I would put in front of somebody before I started trying to reskin Catan. And there's Root, like we just mentioned. There's an entire series called the fucking Coin series, right? I mean, and it's not like they're a secret. They've been some of GMT's best-selling games for 10 years. The godfather of them all is a flipping CIA analyst, and they didn't sneak up on anybody in the military because there's article after article after article in the professional military press about using these things. So they didn't come out of nowhere. There's the old Victory Games Vietnam game. There's the old Central America game. There's the Blood Tree Rebellion game. And again, I'm just listing stuff off the top of my head. I haven't even started digging yet. So there's no shortage of other things that you can throw out there to teach guys about counterinsurgency ops that you can grab and run with. And if all of those are too high of a barrier to entry for you, go grab Brian Train's Guerrilla Checkers, and you can probably play it 10 times in the time it would take for you to assemble the board for this one. So it's not like there's a shortage of other ways to do this than ripping off Settlers. So any last words on this one before we move on to a couple of other topics on game ripoffs? Jim, any final thoughts here?
I just agree. I think it was a straight, and I'm not even going to use the harsh word ripoff. I think the real question that's before us, because they, again, they're not trying to sell Catan to Catanites. They took a bunch of pieces from Catan and built a whole other game. The real question is, are we comfortable with people, whoever they may be, military or not, patenting mechanics and empowering those that might want to stifle a little bit of creativity down the road? And then I will get into the question raised by your other guest, and I think it's a valid one. Master's theses, like PhDs, I realize not quite as much given the level, these are supervised exercises. You know, they're supposed to be a director here. I do wonder where the director was to go, you know, fellas, this was great work. We should try to get this out into a paper. We should try to, you know, get into a publication. We should try to really highlight this because I think this is great work. Why they thought patenting it was a good idea is a question that I still don't have a satisfactory answer.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that one. I think that's just a general lack of knowledge of how the industry works that they're trying to somehow insert themselves into. Ian, any wrap-up thoughts on this one?
I'll just echo what Jim there said. It's the patent piece. That's the bothersome stuff. Are they really trying to patent mechanics? And what is the impact that going to be on the hobby and professional gaming industries? If somebody goes off, is this going to become the new norm? Are we going to start to see game companies fighting each other because, oh, you patented my term, you used my term? I don't think any of the designers out there want to see that happening. It's a pretty friendly, yes, there's the cutthroat pieces in places, but overall it's a pretty friendly organization. I don't think we need that level of legal intervention that'll get in the way of just good gaming.
Yeah, we hope not, for certain. Just so folks know what's linked on the page with the article here, we've got the thread from the Tabletop Attorney talking about some of the issues around the unconventional warfare stuff, to include some of the conversations between the Dragoons and him. We've got his actual blog post around patents and wargaming that lays out some of those differences between trademarks and copyrights and patents. We've got the article from TechLink that sort of speaks of this in glowing terms, as though nobody's ever done tabletop wargaming for the military, which just really speaks to the overall ignorance of the writer. And I say ignorance not in that negative of a term. He just doesn't know the breadth of the community that he's trying to describe. So to him, it looks like something new and cool and novel, when in fact it's really not. He just doesn't know enough about the topic to really describe it. It would be like me trying to describe some really cool new medical device that happens to be one of, two dozen that do the same thing out there. And then we've also got the Pax Sims article linked that was written by one of the designers over at CNA, Center for Naval Analysis, talking about the idea of some patents and mechanics and whether or not you can or should patent different wargame mechanics. One thing I did find interesting, Ian, you'll recall the other day, like when all this flurry first exploded, it was the SOF News Update Twitter feed that posted the TechLink article about this that said, hey, this looks kind of cool for the special ops community. And everybody went, yeah, but, and that's where all the yeah, but started to come into. SOF News Update has deleted their original tweet linking the article. So they're covering their tracks a little bit there. I want to shift gears here a little bit, and let's talk about a couple of other game ripoff things out there. But one in particular I want to bring up, I was actually involved in some of the discussions on this in the early part of last year, so late January, early February of 2019. The guys over at Stronghold Games were soliciting a game called Aftershock that dealt with sort of the emergency rebuild of a city that had been hit by a major earthquake. And Ian, I don't know how familiar you might be with it. Jim, I know you're at least passingly familiar with the existence of the game called Aftershock that was developed by Rex Brynen and a whole bunch of others, that has been published specifically for the professional disaster relief community, whether it's Army Reserve units or NGOs or government agencies or anybody else, to help them game their way through an exercise in responding to a major earthquake in a particular country. Now, it's loosely based on the Haiti earthquake experience from, you know, a decade and a half ago or whatever. It's loosely based on those relief efforts, but it's got its own twists and turns to it all, and it's just called Aftershock. You know, it's a humanitarian assistance game. Well, so Stronghold is getting ready to solicit this Kickstarter called Aftershock, and Rex and a couple of others sort of waved the flag up there and said, hey guys, there's already a game out there called Aftershock, and the concern isn't so much that you're kind of violating the name. Our concern is that if folks who are not familiar with the hobby gaming industry but are looking for the training tool go looking for it, that Stronghold's sort of SEO, intentional or not, is going to cause that game to jump to the top of any searches that people are doing looking for this humanitarian disaster assistance development tool. And the concern is that people in the professional world were going to end up accidentally ordering the wrong thing because they just didn't know any better. And it's not an invalid concern. It's not an earth-shaking concern, but we didn't want, you know, Rex didn't want people ending up with the wrong game. And so he had reached out to the Stronghold Games guys at first and got a brush off from their lawyers. And then it started to blow up a little bit on social media. And ultimately, and this is really cool, Rex was able to actually get with Steven, the guy that runs Stronghold Games. He's also the sitting chair at Gamma right now. And I'm never pronouncing this dude's last name right. It's Bonacor, Buonacor, Jim, any Bonacor. Idea? Bonacor?
It's Bonacor.
Okay, Bonacor. Good. Thank you, because I butcher that dude's name every time, and I don't mean to. By all accounts, he's a perfectly nice dude. He and Rex have been able to work something out. The Stronghold game was renamed Aftershock San Francisco and Venice, so that they cleared up the confusion in there. But in there, in those discussions where I was on Rex's side saying, you know, hey, the issue isn't that people are going to, you know, the issue isn't hobby gamers ordering the wrong thing. The issue is the professional guys that don't know anything about games might accidentally order the wrong thing. So there's some mook on Board Game Geek who decided to start taking some swipes at me and pointed out, so I've got a free download print and play game available on Board Game Geek right now called Strike Force Hunter that's been out there for almost 15 years now. And it's sort of Stratego-ish, chess-ish, but again, it's a free print and play game. You print it out, you move it around out there. It's called Strike Force Hunter. This guy's saying, well, there was a game called Strike Force 1 from 1977 and republished by Victory Point Games. How do you know people aren't going to get confused by these two things? And I'm like, dude, Strike Force Hunter is a free print and play download. If you download it and you realize you got the wrong game, you delete the PDF and move on. Like, what are you, you're out 5 minutes of your life. I'm sorry, but there's not really a confusion issue there. And he also took a swipe at me. And Jim will, I'm sure, laugh at this. So Orange Crush has been sitting out there since 2007, right? I mean, we've made fun of this numerous times on the podcast. You know, I had designed a game that in 2007 was a hypothetical civil war in the Ukraine, and it's gotten a lot less hypothetical over the last 13 years. But at the time when I was first designing it, I had delusions of grandeur that this could become the first in a series of potential near future modern conflict games. And I originally called them the Next Wars series, Wars plural. And this guy says, well, you know, you've got this unpublished Next Wars game. How are you planning to differentiate it from the GMT Next War brand of war games? Well, let's see. The first post over at ConSim World where I'm talking about Orange Crush was 2007. Next War Korea, which was the first of the titles from GMT, was published in 2012. So it's not like I could look 5 years in the future and say, oh, hey, I should change it. Am I going to publish anything under the Next War's name today? Fuck no. Like, I'm not an idiot. Yeah, well, I probably am an idiot about plenty of other things, but not about that one. And then, of course, there's the long-running Brant's personal crusade about the Warfighter series, that if you ever bring up Dan Versen's Warfighter, I'm always insistent that you refer to it as Dan Versen's Warfighter games, because I had published a whole bunch of Warfighter games under that Warfighter name, 2005, 6, and 7. So I wanted to throw those things out there before somebody comes back around to us and says, well, Brant, you've been ripping off game names forever. Well, actually, I kind of hadn't. It kind of looks like it does, because I was a small nobody vanity press self-publisher dude out there, but I happened to get two names out years before much more popular companies ran with something with a very similar name. Quite frankly, like, I was never going to fight GMT over the Next Wars title. Like, first of all, GMT's a real company and going to kick my ass, but my stuff never made it off the drawing board. It made it into playtesting, but it's never gone to press. What do I have to fight with? Like, I got nothing. Like, there's no way I'm going to fight that. I'm going to change the name on my stuff if it ever gets to print. Jim, I know you're going to still make fun of me about Orange Crush never seeing the light of day, so go ahead.
Well, this is always the problem, and I followed the Bonacore thing with great interest, because this is part of the problem of hobby gaming going big time. I'm absolutely going to agree with Ian that this is basically a really healthy community that understands that all kinds of things get swapped and traded, and nobody invented, at least I don't think anybody has claimed they've invented deck building, right? We all think of Dominion, but I don't think they've made any serious attempt to copyright it. And I think the same thing goes to titles. What everybody wants to do is avoid tripping over each other and getting people confused. There are already so many games out there. Just go to BGG and Google, just search on the BGG engine how many games they got out there. It numbers in the thousands. So if you put two games too closely adjacent to each other that aren't distinguished from each other, you're just going to bury each other. And then, God forbid, you're the 800-pound gorilla game that comes out and just crushes the other game. And the example I always think of, there was a delightful little game that came out that was called Castaways. It was a lot of fun. It's a little game about surviving on a desert island and digging around and all this other stuff. It came out at the same time as a game called Robinson Crusoe. And Robinson Crusoe just annihilated it because of this. And so published, just like when people do movies or books or anything else, now they've got to sort of be aware of each other and who is in the space first and is this mine and is this yours is less important, I think, than, hey, don't crush me and I'm going to try not to crush you. I want to win. I want to make money. I want to sell my game. But, we got to be aware of that. I am not talking about people who do outright ripoffs. That's a whole different thing. But I think now that there are so many games trying to get to market, there is an increased sensitivity to what other games are out there in that same space. What are the other games doing? Because do I really need this? I cannot believe, just taking one other example, how many roll and write games exist. I am just stunned at how many exist. I like to call them advanced Yahtzee, or Yahtzee for veteran Yahtzee. I'm stunned how many exist. And they're just in a big pile. They're in a big, indistinguishable pile. And so I would hope there'd be more awareness of that. I don't know that that comes to legality, copyrights, patents, trademarks, but boy, oh boy, does it cause confusion in the market.
At least one of those roll and writes is my fault. It was a free PDF download that I had on one of the websites at some point. But again, it's free, so if you don't like it, I'll give you your money back. you were talking about things of the same name. I just hit the Board Game Geek thing because I happen to know of one off the top of my head. It's not a very common name that you would expect to trip over. And you want to guess how many different games out there are called Mare Nostrum?
Oh man.
I'd say about a dozen.
Distinct games, not expansions, because God knows Uva's the king of expansions these days.
Since I got a bid, I'll say 11, just because I'll take the Price is Right strategy.
You're both a little high, but not by much. It as near as I can tell, it appears to be 7 distinct games and a whole bunch of expansions. Because there's one from back in 03, there's Uva's one from just a couple years ago, there's a Modern War magazine game from 2015, there's the Second World War at Sea Mare Nostrum one from Avalanche, there's one from way back in 1984 that I'm not 100% sure where that comes from. And then there's another thing that appears to be some sort of role-playing-ish something. So I think that was at 6 or 7, somewhere around there. But again, that's not a real common term that you would expect to find a whole bunch. You know, it's not like, you know, truck stop or something. I mean, it's, you know, that's a pretty specific term. And there's a half a dozen different games out there floating around with that one particular name. So,
But Brant, what you just did is what I think the whole aftermath issue revolved around. You just went to Board Game Geek, which is not an official site of the board game industry, but certainly a big piece of the business. And you just Googled the name.
Yeah.
And when all this happened, I was in the middle of it too. I earned a block from Stronghold for a while there because I was nagging at them that they hadn't done the basics.
Yeah.
Like in the patent. Prior art. Well, here you just haven't done the basic. Hey, and a lot of people pointed out to Steven, hey, why didn't you just look at the name? Is there something else out there?
Yeah.
And hey, you missed an opportunity. Here's a guy who's doing a humanitarian, NGOs, you know, trying to do some goodness in the world. You know, why don't you team with him? And eventually that's what ended up happening. It took a long way to get to the right place.
Yeah.
And it was a very simple way to get there is just go to Board Game Geek, look at the name and go, let's see, do I need to maybe make mine a little bit different? Or, hey, is there an opportunity? And they missed it.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right, it's not like an official industry representational thing, but I'll bet even if you called Gamma and said, hey, I'm curious if there's a game out there by this name, they're going to tell you, go to Board Game Geek and type it in the search, see what you find. You know, because that's as good as you're going to get from anybody. I want to shift topics here just a little bit because we're around an hour now, but there's a couple others I still wanted to get to in all of this. When we were talking game ripoffs, there's been a couple of them that have popped to mind over the years of places I've seen where there were just flat out straight ripoffs of other things. One of them I actually used to have on one of my tablets. It's an older Kindle. I'm not sure if it's even still working anymore. The Kindle, not the software. Before the official Seven Wonders mobile app was ever released, some dude put out a rip-off tabletop game that would probably get his ass kicked by multiple IP lawyers if anybody cared enough about it, because he's actually charging money for this thing through the Amazon App Store. It's not available on the Google Play Store, but on the Amazon App Store, if you go looking for Seven Kingdoms, you'll find a Seven Wonders based board game that has rethemed Seven Wonders with the Game of Thrones characters. So, Jim, what would your attorney buddy do to that guy?
Well, and that's the thing, is you get the C&D and we see what you do.
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of these guys are quick buck artists. You know, they want to get in there, get their money and get out and say, oh, sorry, didn't know. Sorry, didn't know.
Yeah. I don't know how this guy could claim he didn't know when the Seven Wonders, the actual Wonder Boards, for folks familiar with the Seven Wonders game, those Wonder Boards, he's got keyed not necessarily to wondrous locations in the Game of Thrones universe. He's got them keyed to specific characters. So you're playing as Tyrion or Daenerys or Jon Snow or Margaery or Hodor. Why Hodor? I don't know. Or Melisandre. I've played this thing before. So, you know, different terrain, the things that give you the resource cards, there's deserts, there's whatever else out there. Some of the locations out there, you know, there are the Steps of Volantis, where one of the markets is set up in Volantis. And the Night's Watch are one of the military cards that you can play that give you, you know, give you some swords and shields towards your military strength. So there's, I mean, this is a straight Seven Wonders ripoff in the mechanics, and the dude reskinned it with Game of Thrones IP. It just cracked me up when I saw it. I was like, holy balls, this dude has some serious cojones to think he can get away with this. And this was 5 years ago. It's still on the Amazon App Store. Like, he's still got it there. And when I got it 5 years ago, it was a free download. Now the guy's charging like $1.50 for this game. He's not gonna, you know, he's not gonna make a fortune off of $1.50 with that, but the guy's making money off of one person's game reskinned with another person's IP, and nobody's told him to stop. Like, I can't figure that out. It just cracks me up. I can't figure that out. The other one that I think some folks may be familiar with, Jim, you've mentioned Dominion a couple of times with the deck building piece. There was a web browser based version of Dominion for a long time, hosted over at a site called Isotropic, where you could match up with folks and play online on there. Board game Wargame Arena had always had an official adaptation available of Dominion, but they were pretty slow to get the expansions out. The guys at Isotropic got it out really fast. And the folks over at, who's the publisher on Dominion? I don't have it right here in front of me where I can see.
I think it's Rio Grande.
I couldn't remember if it was them or Queen Games, because I know Queen's done a bunch of Vaccarino stuff over the years. Whoever it is, they hit them with they hit Isotropic with a cease and desist and said, look, we're about to come up with our own web-based version of the game. We need you to shut the server down. The guy shrugged and said, all right, no problem, and he shut it down. Like, there was no fight about it at all. And even today, if you go to the Isotropic page where the Dominion online thing used to be, he still got the letter that said, I shut it down because they sent me a letter and said, you need to shut it down. And I said, okay, no problem. And I'm not giving out the source code, so get over it. But for a mobile implementation, the official version of Dominion on the mobile was still lagging forever to come out. There was a guy that had created one that he was giving away called Androminion. And it is all of the Dominion cards all the way up. And even though it's been pulled from the Google Play Store, you can still find the most recent build of it over on GitHub. Nobody's charging any money for it, but it is a very low graphic version of Dominion with a couple of pretty smart AIs in it that you can sit there and play Dominion on your phone for free. No graphics, but all the cards pretty damn well accurately modeled, and where the card effects don't work the way they should in the game, it's because there's a bug in the code that caused the whole game to crash, not because the cards are misbehaving. And it's a pretty realistic version. Quite frankly, if I were the guys, that own the Dominion IP, I would just call this dude and, like, throw some money at him to incorporate the correct graphics and roll that out as the official version of the game.
Well, I mean, let's wrap it all the way around to where we started the conversation with Tabletop Simulator. Tabletop Simulator is the wild, wild west for board games. There's a lot of Russians and a lot of Chinese people who are putting up games that are first run, top quality board games, and they're doing king hell great versions of them. And some developers, Steve Jackson Game, Games Workshop, Days of Wonder, aggressively police the workshop to get their stuff taken down.
Yeah.
Others, notably Cole Worley and his folks, they aggressively have embraced Tabletop Simulator to say, no, we want our stuff out there. We want you to playtest it on the assumption. Now, the whole point, of course, is no, they're not getting any money, but also Tabletop Simulator is not making any money on the incremental value of that game that's up there. It's put out there for free. So, you know, these issues are tough. And to go to a point that was made earlier, you are the owner of a copyright or even a patent, and you see somebody violating it. Well, how are they violating it? And are they violating it in a way that you are willing to spend the money it's going to take to hire people like my friend to put on their suit, leave their corona-protected home, and go out there and sue you? Yeah. Are you willing to do that? And that's the threshold we're talking about. Now, I'm not getting into rights and wrongs here. I'm getting into the way the world works. And I can tell you that I was chatting just the other day with David Thompson, friend of the Armchair Dragoons, publisher of wonderful war games. His newest game, By Stealth and Sea, we actually did a broadcast of it on the network. He loved it. He loves that it's out there. He loves that it's being placed as it's out there. And he doesn't think it's going to cost him. He thinks it's going to make him sales.
Yeah.
So we're in an interesting place.
A correction on David Thompson. He is a designer of games. I don't think he's publishing his own stuff.
No, of course not.
He's one of those guys that's selling things to other people. DVG has published several of them, but I think Dave is a designer. I don't think he's self-publishing yet.
That is accurate. Yes.
Like you mentioned, Tabletop Simulator, right now there's a whole lot of options out there. It's interesting to see what gets policed and what doesn't, to come back around to the legalisms of it. One of the things, and my knowledge of this is basically PowerPoint deep, right? You know, Ian, you mentioned sort of PowerPoint deep knowledge before. That's where I am on this, but that's still slightly ahead of a lot of people. One of the issues that those guys are going to run into if they don't send some of those cease and desist letters to folks complaining about tabletop simulators of the world, to folks creating those ripoffs like that, is if you don't send the cease and desist letter, then later when somebody comes around and rips off your official version of something and you send that guy the cease and desist letter, they now get to go into court and go, well, you didn't target the other five guys that were ripping you off. Why are you picking on me? And so if you don't demonstrate even a cursory defense of your intellectual property, is the court going to come back around and say, well, you've abandoned your IP because you haven't defended it against all infringements? And that's a challenge that those guys have to be concerned with. Some of you may remember briefly there was a truck out there, a pickup truck, that was being advertised under the model of the Daytona. And Dodge sent those guys a cease and desist letter. Now, nobody's going to confuse a muscle car with a pickup truck, but the concern was if Dodge didn't send them the cease and desist letter protecting the name of the Daytona, that suddenly anybody could run off with a car called the Daytona because they could always point back to that truck and go, well, you didn't tell them they couldn't use it, so why are you picking on me? And so I think that's where some of those concerns come in. One last one I wanted to mention just quickly here, and this was one that kind of came to a happier conclusion, but started out as a very ugly game ripoff. Ian, you and I were talking about it right before the podcast. Jim, do you remember the lock and load game Nuclear Winter 68?
Sure.
Yeah. Do you remember how that started?
Don't know. You tell me.
It was a print and play download available on Board Game Geek that was a non-sanctioned lock and load product. It was a straight ripoff of the World at War series that this kid grafted on his own sort of fantasy sci-fi theme that sort of said, you know, hey, the Black Hand is emerging from their radioactive underground bunkers and we've got mutants running around the world, and had set it in modern times, but it was straight up, it was the World at War series rules with a handful of special things stripped out. So like thermal sights and shoot on the move and amphibious crossings, a bunch of those things went away because the kid was more interested in rules about mutants picking up and throwing tanks across the battlefield or whatever. Like, I don't remember exactly what all the tweaks were. I remember that the rules were streamlined quite significantly, but he did this without Lock and Load's permission. He just created this thing, threw it out there and go, hey, look, I designed a game. Everybody's like, you didn't design shit, dude. Like, you put some pretty artwork on some mocked up counters. The counters do look kind of cool, but you straight up stole somebody else's rules. This is back when Mark was running Lock and Load. Mark actually reached out to the dude and said, hey, you got a good idea here. Let's figure out a way to make this a real product. And Mark worked with the guy. Now, one of the things they did is they changed the year in which the game supposedly takes place. They backed it up from modern times to 1968, probably in part to have some intellectual distinction and separation between the World at War series in 85 and this thing that was going to be set, you know, a couple decades earlier. But they turned it into an official product, and it got released as Nuclear Winter 68 and sold a crap ton of copies. You know, this was 10 years ago now that this was going on, or, you know, 10 years-ish ago. But what started as a straight up ripoff of one of his rule systems, the publisher reached out to the kid who was doing the ripping off and turned it into an official product. And on one hand, you kind of like, dude, really? You're going to pass this off as your own thing? But it kind of had a happy ending for everybody. The kid got a published design out of it. The publisher looks kind of cool for picking up a fan and saying, hey, this looks really good. Let's polish the edges on it and make it a real product. And the game community gets a new game out of it. So I think that's a, you know, I'm not saying everybody should run out and design their own squad leader ripoff in the hopes that MMP picks them up. Like, I'm not saying that at all. But in this case, it did kind of have a bit of a happy ending. It probably didn't hurt that there were a bunch of mutants and monsters and, you know, all sorts of dark shadowy creatures floating around in a war game that really piqued Mark's interest. Cause we know he loves those kinds of things. But that one had a bit of a happy ending. So, I think that worked out well. And any final thoughts on game ripoffs here as we're sort of poking around at a lot of different issues tonight?
Well, as I was looking at this, I mean, it's easy to be negative and talk about, oh, this is so horrible, this is horrible. But in many ways, I see a positive side to this. And this is just another piece of the growing pain of the industry. I mean, we've gone from small, you know, really small niche publishers all the way up now to, you know, big, you know, Catan, millions and millions of copies sold. But I think what we're seeing here is that the industry is growing up, and what made a long time is many myths and assumptions, and we didn't really know what is legal. And maybe there's some lawyers there that think they do, but most of us as a hobbyist, we don't see it. And I think this has exposed some of that, is that we don't know. So we're trying to, our assumptions are being challenged. But the best part is, I think we're growing up and we're seeing an industry that's gone from a bunch of house rules, is now becoming a bit more formalized. And at the end of the day, I think it's going to be good for us. I think people are going to have their intellectual property protected. It may be some growing pains along the way, but it's going to work out for the best. And we're going to end up with good games out there from good designers and good companies. But we are going to stumble out of the gate, and this may be one of those stumbles right now.
You mentioned that a lot of the lawyers may not, you know, they think they know, but they may not actually know. I'm wondering how much of the world doesn't know, given how much of those legal opinions are primarily based on precedent through existing case law, as opposed to standing statutes. And until any of these things wind their way through courts, we don't have decisions upon which to base any sort of case law. So I think it's a step beyond even where you're describing that, this is a bit of a Wild West, and we haven't got to the point yet where, we've figured out what those answers are, because the courts haven't weighed in. They've never been asked to. So, as you're describing this, one of the things that's coming to mind, and Jim, you may see this analogy real quickly, because I know you're a bit of a music fan as well. It almost reminds me a little bit of the game industry being kind of the wide-eyed version of the kid from Almost Famous as he's first getting on the road with the rock and roll band. And rock and roll was starting to become less of a homegrown thing and much more of an industry. And he's having a lot of the blinders pulled off of him as he's seeing what an industry this is starting to become. And is that what's about to happen to us in hobby games? Are we all William Miller in 1973 on the road with Stillwater, now seeing our board game hobby turn into a full-fledged industry? And some might argue that it already is an industry, and you could make a case that rock and roll by 73 was very much an industry, but I think it was still a lot more of a Wild West than it is today in the music business, for certain. But is that what we're looking at for tabletop gaming, and is that necessarily something we want? I don't know. Jim, what do you think?
Oh, I think the first thing is going to be that the legal community, the legal profession, is going to try to fit it into the known categories.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the fun thing to watch.
Because they can't help themselves.
Right. It's because I'll shock both of you, given your military background. Government and law tend to lag behind the creativity of a society at large. And our capacity to legislate these things, we're still, the standard statement, and this comes from the guy who literally wrote the book on this topic for the State Bar of Wisconsin. The public records open meetings laws of the state of Wisconsin were written before the advent of the internet, and they've not been changed since in any substantive way.
Yeah, the first half of that statement doesn't surprise me. The second does, at least a little.
So they're trying to regulate Zoom, GoToMeeting, email, which didn't exist.
Yeah.
Video records on YouTube, Facebook, social media. It's a nightmare. And I deal with it daily. Same thing here. We're trying to fit into our case law cubes or cubicles. Yeah. We're trying to fit all these concepts of copyright and patent and trademark and hope they make sense for games.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's going to be interesting. But I have absolutely no doubt that this is the product, as was said, of the incredible growth in the industry, its incredible vibrance. I do wonder, consolidates, and the little ones get bought by the big ones. But I could say so much. But I think my point is, as the people who sniff money get closer and closer to it, there's going to be a demand that people start to act according to certain rules, much as you say happened with the music business. I hope that the vibrancy, the independence that has created some, even outside the war game space, I hate to admit it, but outside the war game space, some astonishingly innovative games. I mean, to me, I don't know, my whole childhood, I was waiting for a game like Captain Sonar. Had I found Captain Sonar in high school, it's all I would have done at lunch. I have no doubt of it in my mind.
Let's face it, it's all you do at lunch now.
True. And I just get to do it, you know, I have my own office. But it's just that game alone. I look at it and go, my God, the creativity, the interesting things that they did. I certainly hope that as we regulate, as we fit these things into our cubes, that creativity continues, that innovation continues, and most of all, we can keep playing great games, because that's what's cool.
Ian, thank you very much for joining us. Podcast rookie here. Some great insights, and we hope folks all jump onto your Twitter feed and start following you along there and check out your blog. So definitely appreciate you being here tonight.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it, and it's been a wonderful time. And like I said before we started, you know, long-time listener, first-time podcaster. So hopefully I didn't scare you off either.
Nah, and particularly since I messaged you at what, like 11 o'clock this morning and said, hey, you available tonight?
Okay.
So, you know, that whole short notice thing also helps out quite a bit. For those that don't know, and the situation may have changed a little bit by the time this goes live, on our website, the reason you haven't heard Chris or Mirth on this site, on the podcast for a little while, he's had a medical issue come up completely unrelated to the current COVID crisis going on. But he's been in the hospital for a little while on some breathing machines, under some meds. He had some injuries that he had sustained, and he's recovering now. Things seem to be going okay. It's just time consuming. The body just needs time to heal. But that's why you haven't heard Chris on here for a little while. He's been literally out of commission and unconscious in a hospital bed. So we're pulling for Chris hard, hoping for the best. I'm hoping that by the time everybody hears this, there will be more good news and no more bad news about what's going on with him. But in case you're wondering why you haven't heard him in a few weeks, since it seemed for a while there he was on every other one of these, this is what's going on. Jim, thank you very much for neglecting your day job for a little while to join us on this. We do appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
And we still, one of these days, need to start going back through old magazines again, because I miss doing that. That was a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
And now we've got half the audience going, wait a minute, what's this magazine crap they're talking about? So we'll have to get back to it at some point. Audience, thank you very much for joining us on Mentioned in Dispatches. Look, if you got Tabletop Simulator questions, you want to gripe about sort of game ripoffs out there, you can find the Armchair Dragoons on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We've got the podcast. We're over at our website, armchairdragoons.com, and a very lively forum site there where Jim is the master of ceremonies of the Saturday Night Fights area, which I suspect is going to get expanded well beyond just Saturdays here pretty darn soon. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.